Ms. Summers versus UAL, Mr. Berman.
Good morning, Your Honors. Steve Berman on behalf of the appellant. I plan on addressing just two issues this morning to save the rest for the briefs. And those issues are, first, I'd like to address the trial court's ruling that State Street did not breach its co-fiduciary obligations. That ruling, I submit to this court, rested on a complete disregard for the factual record that was before the court on this issue. Specifically, the court found that at all times, and central to its holding, that the committee members fully understood their duties.
What I don't understand, maybe this is wide of your of the mark, but if the stock market says that United is worth $20, and the analysts say that, what is it that State Street is supposed to do?
Well, Your Honor, at the time that we say State Street should have began a prudency examination.
I know. What would it do concretely?
It would have gone to the committee, and it would have said, first of all, it would explain the duties to override the ESOP that the committee had. The committee didn't understand that duty until
August. Why was that State Street's responsibility instead of the committee's own lawyers, which you seem to agree were qualified lawyers for this purpose?
Because State Street, not those lawyers, the committee's lawyers, is a named fiduciary.
No, but you're saying explain responsibilities as opposed to present facts or something, but everybody knew what the price of the stock was.
Well, let's look what happened. In August, State Street went to the committee and told the committee, by the way, we've been looking at this stock for over 10 months. It's on our top secret watch list. We think that you have an obligation under ERISA to override the plan and to consider selling the stock.
Well, and that's exactly what the lawyers might have been saying, too. Maybe they have a malpractice action.
Well, but the committee's own lawyers, the record is clear on this, State Street's own lawyers were advising State Street that as a directed trustee and as a co-fiduciary, it had an obligation under ERISA to go to the committee and tell them what to do.
What to do? Okay, that goes back to my question, what to do,
well,
right? The stock market says it's worth X, and the analysts say buy or hold. So what are State Street or the committee members, or what are they supposed to do?
Well, look what happened when they did come
forward. No, tell me, what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to predict the future? Are they seers?
No, let's look what happened. When they finally met their duty,
answer my question. What are they supposed to do?
To tell the committee that there are circumstances under which you may have to override the plan.
That's very vague.
And facts now exist that you ought to consider.
The fact is, the stock is worth whatever the market says, and the analysts say, buy, hold, may go up, may go down. Now, what is a fiduciary supposed to do in that situation?
In that situation, a fiduciary is supposed to consider the mix of information. For example, you said that analysts, they're all over the place on United Stock. And as our expert pointed out...
Okay, they're all over the place. So what is State Street supposed to do?
State Street's supposed to say that analysts aren't concerned about a single asset. They rate stocks assuming that people have a diversified portfolio. You only have one egg in your basket, and that egg is in danger of breaking, and you need to consider whether it's prudent to begin selling stock now.
But one of the aspects of your argument that troubles me is, in a sense, the notion that directed trustees of ESOPs are really exactly the same as all other trustees. And, in fact, Congress understood that you were not going to see that kind of diversification in ESOP. So there is a moment at which one does override the actual terms of the plan. I mean, that's a big thing to do, to override the terms of a plan. And I wonder how you think that trigger date is determined and when State Street should have said so. Apparently, you think at $20 a share? Why that?
Well, there's two. You asked a couple of questions. What did Congress seek to impose on directed trustees? There's two branches here that I think are important. One is the co-fiduciary branch. So if they're sitting there knowing that extraordinary events are occurring, they go to every single meeting, they know that the committee members are not even discussing the issue, not a peep. When the CEO is saying this company may perish, when analysts are saying there's a risk of bankruptcy, when Moody's lowers the rating basically to a junk status, meaning that it's imperiled, in those circumstances they had to come and say, have you considered these things? And in fact, when they did, immediately partially because they knew that the committee members had a conflict, the committee members stepped down. They said, oh my gosh, we never understood we had this duty. We resign. You, State Street, take over. And what happened? State Street immediately began selling stock. Now, we submit, that, Your Honor, that that's exactly what would have happened if State Street, when the Goodwin letter and all these other events occurred in the fall of 2001, a company that's losing billions of dollars, when if they come and said, have you considered this? The committee could have done a lot of things. They could have hired an expert to advise them what to do. They could have been selling. Don't forget there was a limit on the amount of stock that could
what
be sold.
What would the experts advise?
Well, our expert says that they would have advised, he would have advised the committee to begin selling.
To sell the whole thing?
No, they couldn't sell the whole thing. There was a cap under Rule 144, and they were limited to 30% of the daily trading volume. So it would have taken a period of time to sell all the stock.
No, no, but would that be the goal, to sell all the stock?
Well, I think the goal would have been to keep selling until prudency changed. For example, what if things worked out wonderfully? Then you stop because it's no longer prudent to sell. So it's an ongoing consideration based on the circumstances of the time.
Is there any date? I mean, is it your position that this October 17th date of the Goodwin letter is the last possible moment for taking this action? Or is there any time between October 17, 2001 and August 29, 2002 that would have been the prudent moment?
Well, I don't think you can draw a bright-line test. I know courts
Well, I'm asking, though, do you have a theory that says there's some other date other than October 17, the Goodwin letter date, which seems to be your theory?
I think there could have been a date at any time from October 17th forward because events continued to unfold.
Not from September 11th, 2001?
Because at that point in time, if you look at the DOL standard, which says when a directed trustee has a duty, when the going viability of a company is called into question, that had not yet occurred.
But that's not really your theory. Your theory is, which is not that bad, not a bad idea, that it's very dangerous for people to have all their wealth in one stock. And so anything that would suggest jeopardy, wouldn't that argue for beginning to sell?
Well, I think when there comes a moment under Steinman v.
Hicks. There was a big plunge in the airline stocks right after September 11th.
When there's a moment in time under Steinman v. Hicks where, I mean, the facts here are much worse than that. You have...
I know, but I'm just curious, what's the rule you're arguing for? At what point does this duty of overriding the ESOP plan...
The rule I'm arguing for is to follow the language of ERISA, which says...
No. Don't give me statutory language. What is your rule, concretely? Does it have a continuing duty to assess risk, volatility, or does it click in at some very specific point?
I think there is no specific point because the word prudency, which is really the test here, it depends on a whole basket of circumstances. And then you're going to have an expert.
That's not very helpful to a fiduciary.
Well, that's what fiduciaries face every day. They can't look at any standard and say, this is when you sell, this is when you hold. What they do is they look at the facts before them, the circumstances before them.
Do we know anything about what other assets the employee shareholders of the ESOP have?
Well, that's not in the record before the court.
I mean, you mentioned diversification, right? So a person who has a diversified portfolio doesn't care whether he's got a stock in there of a bankrupt company.
But a trustee or a fiduciary under ERISA...
Yeah, but it depends on the total position of the beneficiary.
I respectfully
disagree. Right? If this ESOP shares are a very small percentage of the wealth of the shareholders, then there's no particular reason for the fiduciary to sell.
But there's no way a fiduciary of this ESOP could possibly know the circumstances of thousands of pilots.
Do we know anything about the portfolios of the shareholders?
We do not. I mean, we know that some United pilots or employees had a 401k plan. We don't know how much they had in the 401k plan. There's thousands of stories out there.
Do your clients have any stake in this dispute between State Street and the committee members over the settlement?
Oh, we support
But do you have a stake? Does it matter to your members who prevails in that?
Well, sure. I mean, my class would like the settlement to go through.
Why?
Well, because it will give them a tiny, tiny fraction of a return. Nothing more than that. That's the only stake. It's very tiny.
Oh, I see. So you're content with your settlement, even though without the settlement, mightn't you have more of a crack at State Street?
I don't think so, Your Honor. There's no assets to go after on the committee members. Our crack at State Street is through their co-fiduciary obligations. We could still call the committee members to testify at trial, and we were planning on that. So their presence in the case, or I mean, the settlement really aids the case.
But if the union had to indemnify the committee members, wouldn't that provide another source of funds for your clients?
I think that State Street's going to address that issue. I don't think there's any duty of indemnification. If the
wouldn't you like them to have that duty?
Well, if there was such...
I mean, then you could get a $100 million judgment or $600 million judgment against these impecunious individuals, and the union would have to bail them out. Not that the union has $600 million, I'm sure.
Well, we looked in presenting the settlement to the district court, we looked at the possibility legally and factually whether we could go after the union's assets. The answer was no.
No, but suppose the union has a duty of indemnification. Then all of a sudden, these individual union members, committee members, the fact that they have no assets is no longer a constraint.
There is no contractual indemnification. And so whatever right there was, we offered to assign it as part of the settlement to State Street, and State Street declined because it's not worth anything.
You say there is no duty to indemnify.
I do not believe there is.
Okay.
I want to go back to the question Judge Posner was pursuing about what exactly the moment is when, in an ESOP, somebody's got to override the plan. Because if you go back to the beginning, people understand that ESOPs are, in fact, a sort of plan that has only one company's stock in it. And the language used in Steinman is, you know, impending collapse. The district court used the idea of imminent collapse. And I take it your argument is that's too harsh a standard because the value of the stock is already low. But what on the other side respects the idea that when people enter into an ESOP, they know it's risky?
Well, if you take the Department of Labor standard, which doesn't say imminent, it says an extraordinary event such as an 8K filing, which is what happened here, and facts which lead to serious questions about the ongoing viability of the company, that's a trigger, according to the DOL. Now, we think that's too strict, but it's far less burdensome than the trigger imposed by the district court, which, as Your Honor pointed out, it's our contention. It's too late. The horses are already out of the barn, and it offers no protection for the participants.
Okay.
I see my time is up, and I'd like to reserve the remaining.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Berman. Mr. Sunshine?
Thank you, Your Honor. I have a rule. For directed trustees, where reliable, publicly available information calls into serious question the short-term viability of the company as a going concern. That is a rule that courts have held should be the rule that the Department of Labor has stamped and gives certainty to directed trustees in situations where there's an ESOP with one stock, the company stock.
But, you know, that rule does, as Mr. Berman points out, mean by the time that standard is reached, it seems to me the stock value would have utterly collapsed. So there really is no protection under ERISA. I mean, it sounds like it's just a bunch of words, because if you step in and get your 50 cents a share or whatever it is, you really haven't done too much.
Well, first of all, I don't agree that under the facts of this case, nothing has to be done until the moment of imminent bankruptcy. In fact, State Street Bank was constantly monitoring the stock, constantly watching the financial condition of the company.
What does that mean? That doesn't mean anything.
Well,
you don't know anything that the stock market and the analysts don't know, right?
It's all
public. You have inside information.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor.
So what's the monitoring amount to?
The monitoring is reviewing the analyst reports.
Reading the newspaper, right?
Well, in this case, it was, and it is State Street's practice to do substantially more than that.
What does it matter? Look, if it's at 20, that's the best estimate of what it's going to be tomorrow. And if it's at 10 tomorrow, that's the best estimate of what it's going to be tomorrow, because if the market thought it was broke, it would go to zero, right? So what good does monitoring do?
Well, certainly the analyst community reports and the stock market are the best, in our view, are the best indicators of the financial condition, financial health of the company. Monitoring that, talking to the company if necessary, which is exactly what we did, watching the indicators carefully. You can call it, Your Honor, nothing
that's
more than reading
words.
The newspaper.
I mean, that's just words. That's just what analysts do. And, of course, the implication of that is you can ride it all the way down to zero, right? Because when the stock is at 1 cent, that's still the best estimate of what it's worth, right?
However,
so at what point do you have to sell in order to somehow, you know, minimize risk or whatever?
Where there's a serious question going to the viability of the company. And on these facts, this is a perfect example of why there was not a serious question going to the viability of the company until August of 2002. In the entire period leading up to that, and I can take you through it step by step, in the entire period leading up to August of 2002, various things could have happened which would have saved the company. For example, there were union negotiations. There were cost-cutting measures. There was the ATSB loan guarantee, which was applied for in June of 2002.
Was there a sudden break in the stock, or was it a gradual decline?
Well, interestingly, the stock went up
The Goodwin left. I know, but it ended up very low. So on its way down, was there a break when it suddenly plunged, or was it a steady decline?
I'm not ducking your question. It was neither. It was essentially level, and it actually went up for a period until the spring, and then it started to decline.
Well, I'm interested in when it started to go down. Did it go down smoothly, down to
relatively
zero?
Relatively smoothly. It didn't spike.
Or was
spike.
There a break?
It
was
didn't.
There an inflection point?
I don't believe there was an inflection
then
point.
Then how on earth do you know at what point you've got serious jeopardy? If it's just a gradual decline, isn't it completely arbitrary to pick a point and say that's the point where all of a sudden, if there came a point where no hope was left, then it would plunge vertically, right?
It's not, but
if it's just going down smoothly, it means, yeah, there's new information, new negative information, but there isn't some point at which all of a sudden people say, oh my God, this company is going broke.
Well, there was such a point on August 15th.
Then it plunges, right? As soon as the market thinks the company is broke, its stock is going to plunge. It's not going to continue its gentle decline.
And it was the ESOP committee's job and State Street's job as the directed trustee, which was only required to follow proper instructions of the committee, but it was their job to determine when the indicators, the publicly available indicators, called into serious question the viability. And we did that in this case.
What's the difference? I mean, United announces on August 14th, 2002, that without these loan guarantees that it's applied for, it might have to file for bankruptcy in the fall. That doesn't sound too different from the Goodwin letter of October of 2001, where he uses very colorful language and seems to be treated as something of a Cassandra. They toss him out the door instantly and get a cheerleader-type CEO in. So it's United is saying we might have to file for bankruptcy, we might have to file for bankruptcy. And yet you're saying if it was a gradual decline that it doesn't even spike downward on August 15th.
Well, first of all, it did spike shortly after August 15th. It did start going down precipitously after that. But second of all, I believe the differences between the Goodwin letter and the announcement by the company on August 15th are tremendously different. The Goodwin letter was, if you read that letter and sit down and read that letter, you will see it for what it is. It ends up on a positive note. It is a rallying call to the unions. Look, guys, you have to cut costs. You have to go with us. Otherwise, there will be trouble, and the company may perish sometime next year. We're in October of 2001. It's talking about a period 14 months, a total of 14 months, whereas the August 15th announcement used the term bankruptcy, for one, which the Goodwin letter did not use, and said this company will go bankrupt if certain things don't happen very quickly. And
no,
it talked about
it
a very
that,
quick time period.
But what,
huge difference.
There are two points here. I think one of them is really what is the legal standard? Because if the legal standard is imminence, as the district court seemed to think, in the sense of tomorrow or the next day or in a week, you know, the company is going to fold, that's one thing. And there's nothing that I see in the Goodwin letter that would satisfy that standard. If the legal standard is more like just an extraordinarily bad event or threat or something less than, you know, the company's going to file for bankruptcy in the immediate future, then, I mean, although Mr. Goodwin doesn't say the word bankruptcy, he's talking about that will allow us to continue operating. If we don't succeed, we'll eventually run out of money. Well, running out of money is the same thing as being bankrupt. I don't see why the use of synonyms makes too much of a difference.
The problem with a vaguer standard than imminent bankruptcy is that, or a more amorphous standard, is that there won't be any way to judge when to do it.
And the problem with a standard of imminence, though, is what your opponent is saying, that by the time the stock is down to a penny a share, then there really is nothing that the trustees can do to preserve any value for the beneficiaries.
Well, first of all, a penny a share is a very extreme example of that.
$2 a share. I mean, this stock started out even after 9/11. It was at $17.50, and then it, as you point out, went back up again to above wherever. You know, it was like in the 30s, wasn't it, for a little while in March?
I don't believe it was in the 30s, but it was in the teens. It was in the middle teens throughout that period. And, in fact, it spiked up during that period when the analyst community and the stock market.
By what percentage had United stock fallen by, say, from January 1st, 2001 to what the Goodwin letter was in October 2001?
January 01 to it halved after 9/11 when the market opened. So it went from, I believe, 30 to 15, rough numbers. So, and you're talking about January 01, the 10 months before? It was higher.
The Goodwin letter.
It was higher. Before
how much,
the
how much did it fall?
I don't remember, Your Honor.
Didn't
I could
it
obviously
fall
get
by 50% or 75% or something?
It fell substantially during that period.
Yeah, well, 50% is very substantial. Now, of course, what happens is, as the stock falls, the risk to the shareholders is rising, right?
Absolutely.
Well, don't you at some point have a duty to you know, the shareholders are presumably risk averse. Don't you have a duty to sell when there's a big drop off in the stock so that you don't expose these people to a high level of risk?
Not at an ESOP, Your Honor. Not in a single stock ESOP where the plan document says that the investment shall be in company stock. Absolutely not.
No,
it's
shall be, but obviously there are conditions on that. As you yourself concede, right? Shall be doesn't mean hold on to it until it goes broke, right?
That's correct, and the conditions are when it's no longer prudent to
but
hold
when it's
stock.
When its collapse is impending, it's too late for it to... It's too late for the fiduciary to do any good for the shareholders.
Well,
it's waited too long.
State Street did sell $46 million of stock at that point. I mean, the system did work.
But the stock would have been worth what on October 17th? A lot more than that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And
State Street was around a $2 a share price as opposed to a $17 share price, right?
But Your Honor, all this whole conversation that we're having right now, this dialogue, is classic Monday morning quarterback. And let me explain what I mean by that. American Airlines, which plaintiffs cite in their complaint, they cite that's an example where the system worked because the fiduciary stopped buying American Airlines stock when it was down at $2 a share. Very similar situation.
No, you're confusing mean and variance. The $17 may be the best estimate, the $30 the best estimate of the value. But as the price declines, the risk to shareholders increases because you've got a, you know, your debt equity ratio is zooming. So it's one thing for people to be content to hold. I mean, the best example would be, suppose you had a ESOP, one stock, and it's a company that has zero debt. Well, then it's a very safe company. And then suppose it decides, well, we want to be, you know, we want action. So we're going to raise our debt equity ratio from zero to 99%. Now you have an extremely risky company. It's worth just as much, maybe worth more, but it's very risky. And so the situation of the shareholder employees has changed dramatically. Now they have all their eggs in a very, you know, dangerous basket. That's what you don't seem to be giving any weight to.
But where does a fiduciary, where does a directed trustee draw that line? That's the problem we have.
I think that's the only argument you have, actually. It's hard to draw a line.
If I may go back to the American Airlines situation, because I think it's instructive here, and it goes right to this question. American Airlines, the trustee did not sell when it was at 2. The stock went up 500% after that.
You completely missed the point. You have completely missed the point. Completely missed the point.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I apologize.
American was in a very risky situation. Now, I, as a shareholder, might say, yes, I know American may bounce back, but I don't want all my eggs in such a risky basket. I'm risk averse, and I want my trustee to put me into something safer.
But the American Airlines fiduciary would have been sued for selling at $2 a share because ultimately the price went up to $17.
The question is not would he have been sued. Of course he would have been sued. The question is, would he have won the suit? And if he had argued, look, I knew the stock could come back up, obviously, but I thought that my, you know, beneficiaries would not like to be in a situation where they might lose everything because their single asset had become so risky. How would you feel if you had all your money in some fund managed by a fiduciary, he puts it all in one stock, and then the company decides, you know, it's going to gamble, it's going to go for the moon, it's going to borrow huge amounts of money, invest it in space travel and so on, and stock market says that's fine, it's valuable. Anyone who has a diversified portfolio is perfectly content to have this high flyer. But you would be very uncomfortable to have so much risk, to have your assets at such risk.
But, Your Honor, that was not the situation. This was not a highly risky venture. This was United Airlines.
Well, it became risky. UAL wasn't shedding debt as its value declined. So its debt equity ratio was rising and the risk of bankruptcy was growing steadily.
The risk grew over time, but it wasn't a steady increase in risk. I don't agree with that, nor do the economists who looked at this agree with that. There were spikes. There were issues that came up. The union negotiations.
When you talk about the spikes, you're talking about the mean value of the stock, not the risk. The risk never diminished.
I'm not just talking about the stock price. I'm talking about what was happening in the company. Bankruptcy is not created just because of the stock price, obviously. Bankruptcy happens for a variety of reasons, many of which relate to the financial condition of the company. For example, in this case, the burn rate, the cash burn rate, was reflective of the cost situation. The cost situation was reflective of the union negotiations. The union negotiations, if they had gone differently, our experts and everyone looking at it at the time have said that the company might not have gone bankrupt at all.
Now, we know it might not have gone. Look, let me ask you, what is this? I don't understand this settlement business. What is it you're worried about?
Your Honor, I've reserved because it's a separate appeal, I've reserved that for my partner, Mr. Kravitz, to discuss the settlement.
Okay, that's fine. Shall we hear from him?
Or yes. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sunjay. Mr. Kravitz?
Good Good morning, Your Honors. I'm going to address the bar issue in the settlement agreement and why it is unfair for State Street. And I'll also address the question you posed to Mr. Berman. The administrative manual of APA says that APA shall
prevent. What is it you're concerned about with this bar? What is it that might happen to hurt you under this settlement? What is it you're worried about?
State Street loses the right to contribution under the settlement. So that we're in a different position than we would be had the case gone to trial.
But contribution against these committee members? They don't have anything, right? So they have just their insurance, right?
No, there's the APA indemnification rights, which are provided in the administrative manual, which says that APA shall.
In other words, your contribution would come out of would come from the union.
Ultimately, that's correct, Your Honor.
Well, where's the union?
The union would be, ALPA.
No. Why isn't it a party?
We would file the right. I'm sorry?
Why isn't it a party? This case is about the union's obligations. And where is the union?
A right to contribution.
Can determine their rights without their being present?
The contribution claim hasn't been filed yet.
Do you think that your rights against the union can be determined in a lawsuit to which the union is not a party?
The rights would be against the committee member defendants who would have the capacity to pay.
You have nothing to gain from the union members. They have nothing. They're stones. You can't squeeze water out of them. They just had their pathetic $5.2 million insurance policy. You want union money.
Well, two answers to that, Your Honor. One, with respect to the settlement itself, that's not a justification for ignoring the proportionate fault method in McDermott. And second,
you're using McDermott, I think, in an odd way. If you look at the rationale of those cases, they're all situations that do not involve joint and several liability. I mean, you're overlooking that very important aspect of admiralty law and of all the rest of these things. I don't see where you're assisted by that. You are in a situation where if you're liable, then you're liable for everything, even though you're going to get your claim reduction from this settlement. They've already gotten their they'll get their $5.25 million.
Actually, Your Honor, McDermott does address joint and several liability and the proportionate share method and when that should be used. And so does the Donovan versus Robbins case of this court back in 1985. And when you have a settlement, the proportionate share method should apply under those circumstances.
No, I don't think you're reading McDermott right, to tell you the truth. It's very specific to the admiralty context, which has longstanding different rules of liability allocation.
It's an admiralty case, but does not limit itself specifically to admiralty in any way.
It does limit itself, and our later cases suggest that it's limited to situations where an allocation is possible. And you're trying to take your right to contribution from somebody else and parlay that into some sort of right to have only a proportional share of responsibility for a verdict, and I don't think that's at all what contribution's about.
Well, contribution in this case is about State Street having the ability to go after the individual committee members who potentially could have indemnification rights that could be $50 to $100 million or more.
And you know, where do you get your some common law right of contribution you have? Where does that come from?
Well, in the Seventh Circuit, the Free case and other cases have recognized, and most recently the Daniels versus Bercy case at the district court level, have all recognized the right to contribution under ERISA.
We didn't quite go that far, as I recall. District courts may have.
The district court certainly did. Free, my recollection, did recognize the right. In Alton, it was in dicta. But it would make sense under these circumstances because State Street should not simply be left holding the bag where, in effect, they're the secondary fiduciary, the directed trustee, and they would be held responsible for 99% of the losses simply because there's insufficient insurance
that the committee members failed to get.
Where
do you think the duty of ALPA to indemnify committee members comes from? Is that contractual or what?
Section 55 of the administrative manual provides that. And it states specifically that ALPA shall indemnify its members if they're found liable and for court costs for that matter with regard to their duties serving as trustees or fiduciaries of pension plans. What's not here is evidence of how much
So why didn't you want the assignment of that right? Why did you turn that down?
Because the assignment of that right under the settlement would be essentially $5.25 million because the settlement...
Why is that? I mean, they offered to assign whatever it was they had, not the separate and apart from the $5.25 million.
Under the settlement, what the committee members owe is $5.25 million, and all they could seek in indemnification would be the $5.25 million. That's why it's a different situation if we're at trial. And why the plaintiffs gave up that right in this case is unclear to us. They say they examined the value of those rights, but they don't indicate in any substantive way how or they came up with that determination or how much money, indemnification money, potentially would be there. And that's another problem with the settlement. There was not an evidentiary hearing with regard to either the assets of the individual committee members or the value of the indemnification rights. That should have happened at the settlement status of this case.
So what you want is a right to seek contribution on some theory from the committee members, and whatever judgment you got, you would rely on this administrative manual as requiring indemnification. Is that what you want?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But what about the alternative measure in the settlement, the contribution credit measure? I mean, their position is you really can't lose under the structure of this settlement, even though they don't think there'll be more than the 5.25. If there is, that's fine.
But that's why we can lose, because the indemnification rights are also capped by the settlement agreement at $5.25 million.
Where does it say that in the settlement agreement?
Because the committee members, if they were to go to the union and say, we just had to pay $5.25 million, that's all they're going to be entitled to for indemnification. But if this were to go to trial and if they were hit with a $100 million judgment, then they could go to ALPA and say, indemnify us, which also would reduce the exposure of State Street under these circumstances. That's why this settlement agreement is very different from the WorldCom situation, which, one, was a $50 million settlement, and two, which is substantially more than the $5 million here, and two, there was no issue of indemnification. So that was the best they could do in that case. Very different scenario from what we have here. I know my time's up, but...
Thank you, in short,
we would request that the court...
we understand.
Okay. Not approve that settlement. Thank you.
Is that... I have a Ms. Thorne. Are you going to argue, too?
Good morning, Your Honor. I represent the ESOP Committee defendants, so I'll be opposing State Street on the bar order issue.
But what is your stake? The committee members just have their insurance policy, right? What are they worried about?
Well, if the court overturns the settlement, then this case will proceed to trial.
I know, but how can the committee members? They don't have any money, do they?
Well, whatever assets they have will be exposed.
Do they have assets?
As far as we know, they do not. The bankruptcy court made a finding long ago, and State Street was aware of it. The committee defendants did not have assets sufficient to satisfy...
No, we know that. Do they have any assets?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure what any means. I'm sure they have a little money in the bank, but
does State Street, in fact, want to get anything from them or just from the union?
I'm unclear what State Street wants to do, frankly, Your Honor, because we offered to assign them the ALPA indemnification rights, and they declined to take that assignment.
Well, their response is that still would have been the same $5.25 million. Is that correct?
I disagree with that reading, Your Honor, of our settlement agreement. The settlement agreement caps the amount of the contribution credit at the ability of the committee members to pay or the amount of the settlement, whichever is higher. So certainly one could read that the ability of the ESOP committee members to pay is based on the indemnification that would be provided by ALPA. So I don't see it capped at the amount of settlement.
Wait a minute, but now you're arguing on their side. I don't understand. Now you're arguing for State Street.
We have no problem, Your Honor, with assigning our rights under the ALPA indemnification. If they can get money from ALPA, more power to them. But the committee members do not have money.
Wait, I'm lost. I thought what you just said, that your interpretation of the settlement is that they can
Your Honor, if I may try to explain myself again.
I'm lost.
I was responding to the question about whether the contribution credit is limited to the amount of assets.
Under your interpretation of the settlement, what can State Street do now?
State Street if it took our assignment.
No, no. What can it do now under the existing settlement?
Under the existing settlement, it gets the most of either the amount of the settlement, $5.25 million, in a judgment reduction credit, or the amount that the ESOP committee members can pay, whichever is greater. So if ALPA decides...
Well, but wait a minute. They can pay whatever greater amount they can get indemnified for.
I agree, Your Honor.
And that's why your argument is that the settlement can't hurt State Street, right? That
correct.
State Street, in effect, already has the most it could get
that's
under the world
correct.
That it would
but
like
then,
to see.
But then you don't have any quarrel with State Street.
Well, State Street wants to overturn our settlement.
But your settlement does nothing for your committee members, because according to you, they can go after the committee members, right?
No, Your Honor. We would bypass the committee members if State Street gets its way. It would be assigned
no, no. What
our
can
rights.
Under your view, what can State Street do now?
You mean if the settlement is approved, Your Honor?
No. Yes. If the settlement is approved, what can State Street do?
State Street, if it is found liable...
No. Please. Don't complicate things. What? All right. Wait a minute. All right. I take that back. Okay. If State Street is found liable for something...
Yes.
Right, okay.
Then it can get under our settlement a credit that would reduce the amount of any judgment against it by the greater of the $5.25 million settlement or any amount that the ESOP committee members can pay. Now, if you take the ALPA assignment...
But how is that... I don't understand. How does that protect your members?
Because State Street knows that our members don't have any money and they will take
then
the $5.25 million... We're here
what's
because
what's your stake? You don't have any stake here,
Your Honor. We have a stake that
you're
that
representing people who have no assets.
Correct.
So what are you doing here?
Well, we're trying to get our settlement approved, Your
Why?
Honor.
You have no assets. I don't understand you.
Well, we have to settle the
you
case.
You have Article 3 standing, right?
We have a settlement, and we had an insurance policy, and we reached a settlement with plaintiffs for a portion of that insurance policy. That is the settlement that we're trying to get approved by the court.
Why? You're not protecting your members' assets. You just said that.
No, Your Honor. We know that they don't have any assets, and State Street knows that they don't have any assets, which is why the question should be...
But you're not protecting their non-existent assets either.
State Street...
I don't understand. What have you... If we affirm or reverse, what concrete difference will it make to the committee members?
The committee members will have to go to trial.
But
they will not. What,
how would they have to go to trial? They just default. They have no assets. I don't understand you.
Well, the plaintiffs will not get any money, for one. Our committee members, our clients, will have to go through the trial of
what
this
matter. What does that mean? Look, nobody has to go through a trial. If you're a defendant and you are assetless, you just don't show up at the trial. Right?
Well, Your Honor, I would never advise my clients not to show
Why
up
not?
At a trial.
Are you protecting their savings accounts? I mean, I suppose if State Street wanted to be really tough, they could, you know, take away the college savings funds or something of these committee members. Is that it? I mean, and not that that would get very far toward the kinds of judgments we're talking about here, but is that it?
What everyone is trying to do is come up with a settlement that is fair under
You're
these
not
circumstances.
Answering your question.
What assets are we protecting? Whatever assets
Whatever
they have.
Whatever they have. But you don't really mean they don't have assets. What you mean, what you said earlier, is that their assets are so meager as compared to the amounts of money this ESOP lost over the period of time that they're not going to come close to that. But I suppose if State Street were playing hardball, they could go after, you know, the kinds of assets that normal people amass over life.
They could. But we shouldn't get to that point
until there's a
judgment. Well,
that's a different
matter.
I think what Judge Posner's concerned about is there actually anything at stake here? And if what's at stake is the potential for going after a $100,000 savings account or something, so be it.
I agree.
Who's,
I mean, yes.
Who's paying your attorney's fees? The insurance,
insurance company?
Insurance company. Where's the union in all this?
The plaintiffs did not sue the union, Your Honor.
Yes, I know, but what about your committee members? And they go to the union and say, look, you know, you have to indemnify us?
The ALPA, in the record, Your Honor, is an affidavit from ALPA saying that it does not know whether it would honor the indemnity, that it has to go to a committee, and then they would decide, in fact, whether they would even honor that indemnity. It's also in the record that ALPA doesn't have enough assets to satisfy what the potential
judgment
is. Of course
not, but it has something, right?
It has something. Yeah. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Berman?
Your Honor, I'd like to pick up on reply with something that you noted in your questioning of State Street's counsel, that during the course of the class period, United Stock went down, and therefore it became riskier. And the reason I hit on that is because I think the prudency requirement, if there's not a bright line in October, then there was a duty to continually examine throughout the class period as things became riskier. So at some point in time, there's a factual issue that the district court improperly resolved, and that is, when did this prudency test kick in?
But what bothers me about your case, apart from, of course, there's a line drawing difficulty, what bothers me is your concept of what it means to examine, because I think what you think examining is about is trying to figure out whether this company will really go broke. But I think the only thing that's realistic is to determine how much risk is being imposed on the shareholders.
Well,
that's a different issue.
Okay, let's go with your example.
It's more feasible to look at that.
All right. But State Street did. For example, as we point out at page 15 of our brief, State Street internally, in May 22nd, said there's a high risk, now that's an assessment of the risk, that UAL will not be able to get concessions from the unions and will not be able to get the loan. That's May 2002. Those two things, be able to get concessions and being able to get the loan, were recognized by everyone, including Mr. Goodwin, as being vital to avoiding bankruptcy. So they're internally saying, wow, the risk is great. Well, at least at that point, there's a factual issue that was improperly resolved against
us. But how would this be framed for trial? I mean, suppose we agreed with you that State Street failed failed to give way to the riskiness, not that it was going to go bank, but just there was a risky situation, just as there was for American Airlines and all the rest. But how would you frame for trial the question, at what point should they have started selling?
Well, I think you could take the DOL standard and say, at what point was there a serious question?
Right. That's my question for you.
Well, when State Street, for example, on May 22nd, says that the two conditions that have been publicly stated by the company to keep out of bankruptcy aren't going to be met, or there's a high risk, at that point, it seems to me there's a clear factual issue for the district court to resolve. Was there a duty that was triggered then? And there are other trigger dates that we would present by the written record, for example, State Street's internal deliberations, expert testimony, to the trial court. And the last point I'd like to make is in response to something that Judge Wood raised, and that is the difference between the August letter and Mr. Goodwin's letter, which the trial court characterizes as only a rallying cry. At page 15 of our brief, we point out that defendants' own expert, their own expert, said there was no difference between those two letters in sum or substance. They both had the same meaning. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much to all counsel. We'll move on to our next case, which is Toler versus